From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. And it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We'll get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. Quite a bit to get to. And our panel today includes Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. And joining us for this segment is Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
So, Caitlin, we have you in so we can talk a little bit about what has been going on at the Ada County Courthouse in terms of the Lori Vallow trial. So we are, what, almost 2 weeks into this trial?
Right. I believe yesterday was day 13. So we're about 2 weeks in. Today they took a break and they'll be back on Monday.
So get us updated on what happened this week, because my understanding is prosecutors have called quite a few witnesses already.
Right. They have called a lot of witnesses, actually. Yesterday in particular, one of the most interesting ones was David Warwick, who is Melanie Gibbs' husband. Melanie Gibb was a good friend of Lori Vallow, and it was interesting, actually, because he began to take the stand and Judge Boyce said, we have an issue that we need to talk about. And it turns out David Warwick had listened to his wife's testimony posted either by East Idaho News or by a true crime YouTube page somewhere. And so that took up quite a bit of time yesterday. They talked about whether or not he would be a reliable witness if he had listened to that. And then he also disclosed that he had read an article about Zulima Pastinez and Lori's brother, Alex Cox, being married. And so the defense basically argued that, you know, he shouldn't be able to testify because he was subpoenaed under the under the guise that he wouldn't read any news articles about it, that he wouldn't listen to any of the testimony. And he did do that. But ultimately, Judge Boyce let him testify. And he told us a lot of really interesting things about how he was one of the last people to see JJ alive, presumably, so that we know. But he also talked a little bit about the fact that he says he's a visionary and he has visions and he sees all of these different things kind of in that same realm of zombies and stuff like that. And so I think the prosecution was trying to, I guess, make him look like some kind of like more of an extremist is what they were trying to portray to the jury yesterday.
And so with his wife's testimony, which happened, now, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, Caitlin, but is she the individual that Lori had told the police where that they were saying that, or she wanted her friend to basically lie to police, correct, and say that JJ was with her down in Arizona?
That's correct. So they did talk about that a little bit yesterday, too. So they had a detective from, I believe, Rexburg Police testify yesterday. And he said that they had originally gone to Lori's apartment to look for Tylee's Jeep that they thought had been connected to a homicide in an attempted homicide in Arizona. So they ended up going to Lori's apartment and talking to people. And after Kay Woodcock had them serve a welfare check to Lori's apartment again afterwards, they started to ask more questions about JJ. Where is he? Have you seen him? When's the last time he's been at school? And Lori said, oh, he's with my friend, Melanie Gibb, and they're at Frozen 2. And originally, you know, Melanie was asked to lie, but eventually she told the police, you know, I haven't had JJ. I was never watching JJ. I don't know where he is.
And then also yesterday, and I know that you've had your Nate Eaton has been in the courtroom this entire time following this trial. But they showed video, correct, of like a townhouse that Lori lived in Rexburg. And this is video that, of course, came from police that has not been shown until now.
Right. They did. I believe this is the third time that they've shown security footage of Lori in the courtroom. So it was Detective Stubbs and Detective Ball from the Rexburg Police Department went to Lori's house, kind of like I said earlier, and they talked to her about, you know, they said that earlier officers said that they had gotten a bad vibe because they couldn't find JJ. So Lori told these officers that one of her brothers was trying to kill her for a $2 million life policy and that she's had to move around because she was scared of him, which is something they hadn't ever heard before. And then the thing that was also interesting was she said that one of the guys that was at her house earlier was her brother, Chad Daybell. And at the time, officers knew that she was married to Chad Daybell. So they knew that wasn't true. But the interesting part of this is that there seems to be so many of these lies that officers knew were lies at the time. And so that's when they started getting kind of a little bit more tentative. So they were at the home and they saw movement at the top of the stairs, and they felt that they began to be really concerned about officer safety. And they think that it was probably Alex at the top of the stairs that was moving around. And so they decided that this was a situation where it wasn't safe. And that's when it kind of escalated from there.
Mm. So at this point, Caitlin, I believe there have been about 18 witnesses called so far by prosecution, 13 days into the trial. But really, I am assuming the prosecutors have a lot more that they will be unfolding in the trial next week. So we are almost 2 weeks into what is being determined to be at least a 6-week trial.
Right. What is really interesting about this, too, is that, you know, they were supposed to hold court today, but yesterday the defense was like, and the prosecution actually were like, this is going a lot quicker than we anticipated. You know, we're getting through these witnesses so fast. And it kind of seems like the defense isn't really cross-examining a lot. Like, they don't seem to be really asking a lot of questions. And so it's just going by so fast. They actually decided to cancel court today because they have all this time allotted for this trial and they're using it too quickly. And so there's still a lot to come, but, you know, the witness list hasn't been publicly disseminated and it's not available. And so we don't know exactly how many summons have been or subpoenas have been out there. And so it'll be interesting to see who else testifies and what else we get to hear over the next coming weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really appreciate you coming on and taking time to talk with us about this and updating us. So thank you so much. That was Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com. We are going to move forward with our Friday Reporter Roundtable and bring in Scott McIntosh and our very own James Dawson. So I know both Scott and Jimmy, you have both reported on this. And Jimmy, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us what is going on with in regards to the St. Luke's lawsuit against Ammon Bundy and what happened earlier this week when the Gem County Sheriff said, sorry, we're not going to be serving Ammon Bundy anymore?
Yeah, it's a very long story with lots of twists and turns. So
yeah.
You just kind of laid out what happened that we found out this week that in a letter written April 12th, you have Gem County Sheriff Donnie Wonder saying that he found Ammon Bundy becoming more and more aggressive. That's his quote with his behavior when he was being served with these civil notifications. Ammon Bundy had apparently called dispatch to trespass these civil processors who, you know, show up to people's doors who need to be served these legal papers so that they can, you know, theoretically be, you know, notified of their due process rights and things like that. Mm-hmm. Normally, all of this is kind of handled electronically, except for maybe some initial papers being served or what have you. But since Ammon Bundy has kind of ignored this entire case for nearly a year, these documents have to be served to him physically as opposed to electronically. So Donnie Wonder, Sheriff Wonder, said that, you know, he doesn't really want to serve these papers anymore. You know, thought that Bundy was at his, quote, breaking point. He was worried about the safety of his deputies, didn't want to risk them, risk their health and safety over a civil issue, even though by Idaho law, he has to serve these documents, which is actually laid out on his website, the Gem County mm-hmm. official website. He has all of his official sheriff's duties, one of which is serving these papers. Anyway, St. Luke's lawyers for St. Luke's filed a request in the Idaho Supreme Court saying, you know, you have to do this. Otherwise, our constitutional rights are being violated. Eventually, Sheriff Wonder did say, yep, okay, I will start serving these papers. Apparently, Ammon Bundy says that he, you know, is still not going to comply with this, not to mention an Ada County judge, Lynn Norton, actually earlier this week, shortly after that news became public, issued a civil arrest warrant for Bundy.
So, Scott, this whole thing is so interesting because once the sheriff said, all right, we're going to serve Ammon Bundy, Ammon Bundy, to my understanding, has now put up a YouTube video saying, well, take all my stuff. But it's not that simple. That's not how the legal process works. You know, the rules he thinks don't seem to apply. And I think we're seeing that with him not showing up. I mean, just ignoring this entire case, assuming that, well, if he doesn't show up, it'll go away.
Right. And that's what precipitated the sheriff being required to serve these papers on him, like Jimmy pointed out earlier. The fact that he was threatening, it raises the question as to whether the sheriff says that he was afraid that the situation was escalating. And so that's why he wasn't going to serve these papers any longer. But that is kind of a shocking argument for law enforcement to make, that a situation mm-hmm. is too dangerous, so he's not going to do his job. Now, like Jimmy said, the Idaho Supreme Court finally compelled the sheriff to do his job. But you also have to wonder if perhaps the sheriff was somewhat sympathetic to Mr. Bundy, which is even perhaps even more concerning.
And I think a lot of people fairly have had that question in regards to that. But at this point, Jimmy, the sheriff, do we know if he has served these latest papers, or where are we in this process?
I do not know that. The latest that I have heard from St. Luke's legal counsel, outside legal counsel, was that they were working with Sheriff Wunder to withdraw their motion in the Idaho Supreme Court, and they had filed that as of yesterday. But I do not know if he has since served any sort of new papers, nor do I know what the current status of the civil arrest warrant for this case in which Judge Norton found him to be in contempt. You know, whether that's been served. And as far as I know, I believe the Idaho Statesman wrote that he would not comply with this arrest warrant and turn himself in. So there okay. could be some kind of showdown coming.
Jimmy, you spent a lot of time at the State House during the legislative session this year, covering all things legislature. And you recently wrote a piece about Governor Little talking about his thoughts on this last legislative session. Something that stood out to me, Jimmy, is that he acknowledges that families of transgender children will likely leave Idaho.
He did. Yeah.
Right. So talk about that, because it frankly, I was kind of stunned that he would say this yet still sign this bill.
Yeah, that was one of my number one questions heading into that press conference that we had with several other reporters from other news outlets. You know, I asked him, you know, we had heard from several parents of, you know, transgender children saying, there's no way that we can possibly stay in this state. You know, our children were suicidal, frankly, prior to receiving these treatments like hormones, puberty blockers, things like that, which, you know, as of January 1st, barring any sort of court action, will become a felony for any doctor who prescribes those. They could face mm-hmm. up to 10 years in prison. And so they, you know, they view that as not much of a choice. You know, we want to preserve the life of our kids. And so when I asked Governor Little that, despite all of the major medical associations and psychological associations embracing and endorsing these treatments as safe and effective, you know, he said, you know, quote, I know it was heart-wrenching, some of the testimony that was given, but we'll see how this plays out. He thinks that extra money that he's putting into mental health capacity, whether it's at the schools or at the community level, could help stem these sorts of rates of depression and suicide among transgender kids, which, you know, are much higher than normal or the average American. And in Idaho, we have one of the highest suicide rates in the country, especially for youth already. So it's, you know, a pretty pressing matter. But he, you know, I pressed him probably two or three times, like, how does mm-hmm. this, you know, how do you reconcile this with your goal over the past 5 years of getting kids to stay in Idaho who were born here and raised here, or attracting them to come back. And he, you know, basically just kept saying, we'll see how this works out. We'll see how this works out.
And in some ways, Jimmy, it felt a bit tone deaf in, and I'm saying this just from having listened to your interview, is that, you know, the idea of, well, let's just put more money towards mental health. Well, we will do that. We will hopefully that will work. And yes, there is mental health counseling when a minor is, you know, going through gender affirming care. But again, as you wrote about, you know, the American Medical Association, you know, they come out in favor of using things like puberty blockers, of also mental health, but to take a big part of the medical care away just seems a bit tone deaf. Yet we are seeing this movement across the country. This is not unique to Idaho.
It is not. No, at least last time I checked, which I guess would have been beginning of April. So things could have certainly moved since then. Idaho, I believe, was the 14th state to implement some sort of laws, you know, banning gender affirming care for youth. Of course, we've seen other states even move further, trying to ban gender affirming care for people even up to 25 years old. Adults. Mm. So I don't know whether or not that's an issue that will be coming up next session in the Idaho legislature. But it's certainly a trend across the country. The ACLU of Idaho said pretty quickly after Governor Little signed that bill that they are seeking plaintiffs. They are trying to find people who will be affected by this so they can sue to block this law from taking effect in January.
So other than these hot button issues, because I know the governor did talk about his veto of this so-called, you know, porn library bill. Other than that, I mean, Jimmy, how did he feel about the remainder of the session?
I would say pretty good. I mean, of course, I think it would be difficult for any governor. I mean, I've been covering state government for, you know, more than 10 years now. I don't think I've ever heard a governor after a legislative session say, yeah, you know, this one kind of was a stinker. Like they mostly like to say that, you know, oh, we got most of our priorities and this was, you know, nothing new. He said that he got, I think, 95% of what he wanted done, which, to be fair, I think was generally pretty accurate. I mean, he got the Idaho Launch Program, which is, you know, up to $8,000 in tuition grants to pay for in-demand careers training for high school graduates. That was a huge lift. That was his number one priority, but it did eventually pass. You have the property tax bill, which, you know, he celebrates now. But of course, if people remember, he actually vetoed that bill originally because for a whole number of reasons. But then he certainly embraced it. And of course, he's spent is directing hundreds of millions of dollars toward road and bridge maintenance, which, you know, isn't the sexiest of topics to talk about necessarily, but it's something that affects most of our everyday lives. And our infrastructure was not in really that great of shape prior to the last couple years when he's been able to, with the legislature, approve, like I said, hundreds of millions of dollars to knock out that sort of backlog.
Scott, I want to bring you back into the conversation because a bit of controversy over a proposed new home community, a fairly large one. So two cities in the Treasure Valley were really opposed to this, but Ada County said, well, we're going to approve it anyway.
Right. This is the Spring Rock development, and this is east of CUNA, south of Boise. Boise did not want to include this in the city of Boise, and the city of CUNA actually 2 years ago or 3 years ago now actually voted against it. This is a development that has proposed now 3,000 homes over 761 acres. And it's about 4 miles east of Deer Flat and Meridian Roads. Most folks know that intersection in CUNA. And that's kind of the farthest east portion of developed CUNA right now. And this is east of the Falcon Crest golf course. And so if all this sounds familiar, it has definite shades of Avamore, which we've been talking about mm-hmm. and writing about. And this was a community that was approved by Ada County several years ago, north of Eagle. And now to continue development, Avamore annexed into Eagle. And I suspect we'll see the same thing in the future where Spring Rock will want to annex into the city of CUNA. The problem is that CUNA is not capturing any of the impact fees of any houses that get built because this is outside of city boundaries and in unincorporated Ada County. And so the commissioners approved this development, and there are a couple more steps, but this is, you know, pretty much a done deal that they're going to be able to go ahead and start building. And, you know, it's kind of like we didn't learn from our mistakes of Avamore, and we're making the same mistake all over again with Spring Rock.
And Scott, I know people have made public comment on this. I mean, residents. So it's not just as if city officials were saying, please don't do this. I mean, people who live in these communities and near where this area will be built out are not pleased about this.
Yeah, there were a couple of folks who were concerned about water. And I'm not sure if this will be hooked into Veolia water system. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple of neighbors who testified that their wells had run dry and they were concerned about added water pressure, or I should say decreased water pressure, pressure on the water system in that area. ACHD, Ada County Highway District, also a couple of commissioners came out very strongly against this, saying that we can't afford to be building out in these leapfrog communities and build roundabouts and widen roads out in the middle of the desert. And so they testified against it as well. But Ada County commissioners didn't listen to that negative testimony and went ahead and approved it anyway.
So wrapping up our roundtable, I have about 2 minutes left or so, Scott, and I do want to get very quickly to this opinion piece you recently wrote about a divide in the United Methodist Church.
Right. This is, some people are calling it a schism. And in some parts of the country, it is definitely more pronounced. But this is a division over whether to ordain gay clergy or perform same-sex marriages. The United Methodist Church, in practice, has been accepting of the LGBTQ community and have been ordaining gay clergy and performing same-sex marriages. But it turns out that it's actually against the United Methodist Church doctrine, which says that homosexuality goes against the teachings of Jesus Christ. But there's another part of their doctrine that says that all human life is of sacred worth. And so many in the United Methodist community are embracing that part of the doctrine and performing these gay marriages and ordaining gay clergy. And so some conservative churches are asking to leave the United Methodist Church. Many are forming their own new denomination, a breakaway denomination, the Global Methodist Church. In the Southeast and in Texas in particular, there have been hundreds of churches that have left. There are about 2,000 churches out of 30,000 churches that have left the United Methodist Church. We haven't had any in the Northwest yet. However, on May 6th, there is a general conference of our local region, and about 30 churches out of 400 churches in the Northwest have applied or are considering leaving the United Methodist Church. And so we'll find out May 6th how many of those churches are disaffiliate from the United Methodist Church and whether there might be even more.
Okay. Well, as always, I want to thank all of our reporters for all of the work that they do and for also taking time out of their busy schedules for joining us today. And be sure that you do find them online and follow them and also read all of their news and information. So a big thank you to Scott McIntosh. He is the opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. And thank you to Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com. Kim.com, who joined us for our very first segment, getting us updated on what is going on in the so far 2-week trial of Lori Daybell-Vailo. Of course, EastIdahoNews.com has someone in the courtroom. They are covering this on a daily basis if you are so inclined to continue to keep updated with that. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.